of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, January 31st, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Educators disagree on Prop 92, the Community College Funding Initiative, and what's really behind the Indian gaming propositions on Tuesday's ballot. Plus, the Actors Gang presents Carnage, a comedy. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. When Californians head to the polls next Tuesday for the state's primary elections, they will also decide on four American Indian gaming propositions on the state ballot. Originally, compacts signed by Governor Schwarzenegger and four Southern California tribes, the agreements would significantly change the relationship between state and local governments with Indian casinos. Though already ratified by the California legislature last year, groups opposed to the compacts gathered enough signatures to force the issue to be put on the ballot. Proponents of Propositions 94 through 97 say that the deals allowing four Indian gaming casinos to add thousands of new slot machines will ultimately benefit California's budget shortfall. In exchange for expansions, a larger share of revenues from the casinos would be paid to the state annually, in addition to a quarter of all new profits from the new slot machines. Opposition to the compacts has come from a diverse group, including competing Indian casinos, a horse track owner, hotel and casino worker unions, and Native American groups. Some tribes are concerned that the propositions, if passed, will largely concentrate gambling revenues into the hands of only four tribes. Others are demanding that the California Nation's Indian Gaming Association use increased revenues to restart California's DQ University, the nation's first indigenously controlled college. My guests this morning are Quanah Brightman, he is the Vice President of United Native Americans, Inc., and John Gomez, Sr., Vice Chairman of the American Indian Rights and Resources Organization. Welcome to Uprising, Quanah and John.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing very well. Thanks so much for joining us. John, I'd like to start with you. So I explained a little bit about these propositions and what it would mean for a yes vote. But can you explain for our listeners what the agreement currently is with the California legislature that was signed by Governor Schwarzenegger?
Basically, what these big four, and I'm calling Saquon, Pechanga, Morongo, and... Saquon, yes.
Saquon, mm-hmm.
Yes. Basically, these big four signed a sweetheart deal with the governor in which they were guaranteed by the governor to allow them to have 17,000 additional machines, and for that, the state would get approximately what they're saying, which is very, very, very overrated. $9 billion over 23 years. And they were given another concessions and virtually gave everything away. We, the proponents of it, by the way, that would gathered 3 million citizen signatures to oppose this, feel that the state of California could have gotten a very, 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 very better deal than the one that the governor gave away the, so to say, gave away the store to. And that's why we're there, because it shortchanges, the police and fire departments in our school. There's no not one penny guaranteed for schools. It's unfair to taxpayers. These deals with the big fours manipulate the revenue sharing formula and decide how much to underpay the state. You know, no independent auditors would choose which slot machines to pay on. Even the state's independent nonpartisan legislative analysts say that these revenue promises are unrealistic. Non-gaming tribes will not receive a penny more. In fact, they may receive less money because these people, these big four, would be allowed to pull out of the revenue sharing program. So it's a very bad deal all the way around, and we feel that these need to go back and renegotiate it so that the taxpayers of the state of California can get a better deal. I mean, they're making billions and billions of dollars, and yet they only want to give barely less than 1% of any budget of any department in the state of California. And that's not good enough for the people.
Hmm. I want to bring Quanah Brightman into the conversation. You're the vice president of United Native Americans, Inc. What is your main contention with these propositions, 94 through 97?
Well, what really bothers me, myself, and our organization is the fact that, quite honestly, these tribes are putting out there, these four main gaming tribes that are basically trying to put a stronghold on Indian gaming here in the state of California, they are putting out to the general public and the general media that they're giving towards education, that they're giving towards, you know, human resources, that they're giving towards all these programs that are supposed to be beneficial for the Indian people, not just California Indians, but all tribal nations. See, that's been part of our main problem for Indian people, is that a lot of mainstream people don't realize that there are many different tribal nations in this state. There are over 100 different nations in this state alone. And as you know, there's supposedly 70 of these tribes out of the 100 that are opposing this. Yet when Proposition 5 was first introduced to expand Indian gaming to this Las Vegas style, all of the tribes agreed to support this. Now you have a division right now where a lot of the real people who actually see what's going on with these propositions and how they're shortchanging not only the taxpayers of this state, but their own people. That's when it comes into issue that we really need to enlighten people on what's really going on. Where is the money going? Hmm. Why is it the fact that DQ University is the only tribal college we have in this state, mind you, and the only off-Indian reservation school that we have in America that service not only Northern Native American people, but Southern Native American people. And it lost accreditation in 2004 and through the Western Associate Schools of Colleges, which is called WASC. And they're now $280,000 in debt. Now, $280,000 for me or you, being an average person, would be a lot of money. But for one of these gaming tribes, when they're raking in an annual budget of $7 billion a year in their industry, that's a write-off. Quite honestly, I mean, just that would look so good for them to actually donate to their only tribal college. They would look like heroes.
And have they ever supported the college?
No. Hmm. And that's the problem. Is see, this school limped along since it was founded back in 1970. November 17th, 1970 is when they acquired the land. And there's been a lot of people saying that our organization has no say in what's going on at this school. But let me tell you something. The founding fathers who actually got this land, you know, from the federal government, because this was part of you know, the Relocation Act and part of actually reacquiring this land from the federal government on this takeover that took place back in 1970 to acquire this land, the 643 acres of prime land near UC Davis. And our organization were the ones that actually wrote the proposals. Dr. Jack D. Forbes, David Risling, who is also a California mm-hmm. native. My father taught there for over 28 years. We do have a say in what is going on since the board that we do have, quite honestly, I think a lot of people are turned off on.
I want to remind our listeners, my guests are Quanah Brightman, Vice President of United Native Americans, Inc., and we also heard earlier from John Gomez, Senior Vice Chairman of the American Indian Rights and Resources Organization. We're discussing Propositions 94 through 97 on next Tuesday's ballot. These are concerning the Indian gaming compacts that were signed by the governor and agreed to by the legislature last year. And, John, so just to reiterate, make it very clear for our listeners, a yes vote on 94 through 97 would simply reaffirm what has already been agreed to by the legislature and the governor, but a no vote would overturn this vast expansion of these casinos by the big four tribes. Is that correct?
Yes, but it would also force the big four back to the negotiating table
mm-hmm.
with the governor, with the concerns of the people of the state of California, because their voice has been heard, to renegotiate a better, fairer deal for all Californians, taxpayers, Indians, workers, everybody involved in this, everybody who's a stakeholder in this. And that's what it would do.
Now, let me ask you, earlier you said, John, that it's not very clear that the revenues that they're projecting that would add to the state budget will really come through. But isn't it certainly, you know, if these tribes were to put forward a large percentage, 25% of their revenues on any machines beyond the 3,000 slot machines, 15% on the on its net revenues, wouldn't that still be a large windfall for a state whose budget is in deep, deep trouble?
Okay, the state's budget was in trouble way before Indian gaming and negotiating of these deals. But to answer your question, there's no provisions for independent audit of these machines. The audit would be by tribal representatives, so it's very limited oversight on what can be audited and what's not. If they went in there and said that they put so many X number of machines on the floor, but they only got this much money for them, you would have to take them at their word. If they disputed it, then it would go to arbitration, the money would be held up. But for the state to even begin to get money, they would have to start generating immediately. And for the state to even get any type of money that they even suggest they talk about, they would have to put 17,000 machines on the floor, which is bigger than 12 of the largest casinos in Vegas. That includes the Mirage, MGM Grand, Mandalay Bay, and Bellagio together, and they would have mega casinos, and that's how that would happen. But to say that they would do that is again some more deceptive advertisement by these tribes.
Quanah, let's talk about the amount of money that's being spent on urging a yes vote on these propositions. Nearly $84 million spent by mostly the tribes themselves into their campaign. But what is the motivation? Certainly it's clear what the motivation of the tribes is. What is the motivation from the legislature and particularly the governor to sign these deals?
That's what's so appalling for Indian people abroad is the fact that now, see, most people don't realize the fact that Indian gaming, most officials and most people who are actually in charge of the money, they're not Indian. They are not Indian. Even in the state of Florida, it's documented fact that the Jewish mob was involved with the startup of Indian gaming when it first started really big in Florida. Now, if you look at Florida right now, the Seminole tribe actually owns the name of the Hard Rock Cafe franchise. Now, that's a multi-billion-dollar franchise that's stationed all around the world. Now, you look at California. California, yes, they are trying to, you know, expand Indian gaming. And quite honestly, it would be a good thing if they would actually honor the agreements to support Indian education and to support tribal sovereignty. Tribal sovereignty, when you think about it as an individual, sovereignty starts with the individuals. It starts with your mindset. It starts with just giving towards people in need. That's part of the Indian code that we have as indigenous people of this continent, is when someone comes to your home and they're hungry, you offer them food. When they are thirsty, you offer them something to drink. You don't just look at them and go, oh, look at me, I have the money. That's colonialism and that's elitism. We don't practice that amongst traditional Native American people. And we're just asking these gaming tribes to just share these revenues as most traditional people would.
I want to go back to what you said earlier and just clarify the origins of this industry in Florida. You used the term Jewish mob?
Yes.
Can you explain that? I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand.
Yeah, believe me, it's mind-blowing. Most people don't realize the fact that when you look at Indian gaming, when you go, like the other day, I went to Seniga personally to request for them in person. I even sent them a letter with our proposal on what it would take to basically get DQU up and operational. Now, if they gave a budget of a minimum of $3 to $5 million per year or per semester to actually help resurrect the only tribal college we have in this state, to renovate it, these dorms that we have up there are just dilapidated. The facilities are dilapidated.
Quan, I wanted to just clarify, though, your use of the term Jewish mob specifically.
Yes.
What does that mean? And can you back it up?
Oh, yeah. If you actually look it up and if you ask some tribal officials out there in the Seminoles, quite honestly, they're going through a lot of the issues that we are going through out here in the state of California. If you look it up online, if you do the research, like a lot of people have, you will see the fact that, quite honestly, Indian gaming abroad is being controlled by the mob. And if the mob is basically involved in our affairs, then it's not tribal affairs.
And what do you mean by the mob?
Exactly what I just said.
Okay.
There are different mobs involved on this. There are a lot of different mobs involved on this that are, quite honestly, they're just doing swindling, ugly tactics to try to persuade the vote on this ugly legislation that, quite honestly, it does need to be renegotiated.
Okay.
And a better deal for not only California voters, but for the educators that need revenue. In case you didn't notice, they are basically funding the war by donating money towards the state to this man, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is nothing but, he has openly stated that he is for this war and he's against brown people. He doesn't care about the general public. Because if he did, the tribal college in this state would have never fell, and certainly not for four mm-hmm. years now.
I want to finally turn back to John Gomez. In our conversation before we did this interview, you mentioned that your organization, the American Indian Rights and Resources Organization, is not specifically opposed to gambling but the gaming industry, but specifically opposed to these kinds of compacts. So if the tribes, the big four tribes, were to go back and negotiate what you thought was a fairer deal, where poorer tribes would get a piece of the pie, where there would be the sort of support and more accountability, you would be for it?
Well, I think all of Californians would be for it, the taxpayers especially when you figure in the fact that these tribes are making billions and billions of dollars profit, that they should be giving more to the people in the state of California. They forgot that in 1999 and 2000, when they went to the referendum process and asked the voters to approve Prop 5 and Prop 1A for gaming, that's what it was for. It was to benefit all Indians and to benefit the taxpayers of the state of California. And this has not come about. We have an opportunity to right this, to make it right. You know, the big four tribes are some of the largest contributors to state politicians. And it's not a wonder. It's no surprise to see that among many of the politicians that they endorse, that they vote the way that the big four want them to vote,
mm-hmm.
you know. But, you know, there's people that know the truth, like the California Federation of Teachers and the California School Employees Association. They oppose these deals because, contrary to big four advertising campaign promises, not one penny is guaranteed for our schools.
Right.
You know, and as far as shortchanging our police and fire departments, you know, it's appalling. That's why you had the Professional Firefighters Association and the California Federation of Teachers again that oppose these deals because of this. And you know, and these people have put on a deceptive ad. They brought these people out and showed you these people to make you believe that it's for this and it's for that. They have this lady in a classroom setting saying that she was nominated for Teacher of the Year, saying that this is going to be good for education. But not one penny of this money is guaranteed for education. And I believe with these billions and billions and billions of dollars that are being profited by every year, that the state of California, especially the taxpayers, should be able to get more than this little pittance that they rely on the tribes to say how much they're going to give them, because mm-hmm. there's no independent audit of how much they're going to give the state of California.
I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us today. John Gomez, Senior Vice Chairman of the American Indian Rights and Resources Organization, and Quanah Brightman, Vice President of United Native Americans, Inc. The two of them take a no position on Propositions 94 through 97, which if people vote yes on these propositions, they would only confirm what the big four tribes have signed last year with the California legislature hand the governor a no vote would send the tribes back to the negotiating table with the legislature to negotiate different deals. That's Propositions 94 through 97. And later in the hour, we will be taking a look at another proposition on this year's ballot, on Tuesday's ballot. That's Prop 92. It's the Community College Funding Initiative, and educators disagree on that one. And stay tuned to hear two different positions on that particular proposition. After this radical day in history, we'll hear about Carnage, a comedy. Stay tuned.
Do you have doubts about the official 9/11 story? Want to hear from professionals who have the facts? Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth would like to invite you to a special event called Architects, Engineers, and Scientists Examine the Evidence of 9/11. Special guest speakers will include architect Richard Gage, physics professor Stephen Jones, and KPFK's own Christine Blasdale. Oh yeah, there will also be a certain African-American Green Party presidential candidate joining us. You know what I'm saying? It all takes place on Saturday, February 23rd at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, located at 3300 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. Seating begins at 5 p.m. For more info or details on discounted pre-sale tickets, please call 805-653-1588. Again, that's 805-653-1588. You can also visit kpfk.org for details. Once again, that's Saturday, February 23rd at 5 p.m. at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church. KPFK is a proud media sponsor of this event.
People, the time has come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, January 31st in 1927, a play, The Drag, a homosexual comedy in three acts, first opened up in Bridgeport, New Jersey. Written by the audacious Mae West, this production drew a lot of controversy and was strictly banned from Broadway in New York. For inspiration, Mae West frequented the most popular gay cabaret in Greenwich Village, auditioning those same drag queens for her play. West considered sexual expression to be a basic human right, and she was also an early advocate of gay and transgender rights. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Welcome back to Uprising. 20 years ago, a play called Carnage, a comedy, poked fun at the religious right, back when it was barely entering the American consciousness as a formidable political movement. The play was written by Adam Simon and actor-activist Tim Robbins, and is being now revived by the Actors Gang here in L.A. Carnage follows the pilgrimage and ultimate demise of a fictitious televangelist named Cotton Slocum, played by V.J. Foster, who is also the associate artistic director of the Actors Gang. Carnage, a comedy, opens on February 2nd at the Actors Gang, located at the Ivy Substation, 9070 Venice Boulevard in Culver City. I spoke last week with V.J. Foster, earlier this week with V.J. Foster. Again, he plays the character of Reverend Cotton Slocum, and I asked him to begin by explaining what Carnage is.
Carnage, a comedy, follows the story of the Reverend Cotton Slocum, who, a charismatic televangelist minister who leads a mega church. He is a rapturist. He's convinced, and he teaches his followers, that the rapture will come, and it's coming soon. And when it does, the clean genes, those that have been following his word and have accepted him as their savior, will be lifted up and to live in grace. Unbeknownst to him, his right-wing-leaning young deacon decides to take over his church. And through one mishap after another, Reverend Slocum is led to believe that the rapture has come, and that indeed he has not been lifted up. So he wanders the desert in this lost, semi-insane state, trying to figure out what has happened and why God won't lift him up as he has promised.
Now, this is a play that's, of course, touching upon a lot of issues in today's political context.
Yes.
With Republicans in power and Bush and his very religious fundamentalist base. But the play is, you know, much older than Bush's time in office.
Well, we developed this play as a group in workshop 20 years ago. In 1987, I think we first presented it at the Museum of Contemporary Art downtown as just a workshop piece. Hmm. At the time, you know, we were watching the rise of the Republican religious right, Ralph Reed and the Moral Majority and Jerry Falwell. These people were just really becoming household names under Ronald Reagan's administration, and the specter of this religious political shift was something that we were startled by, and we wanted to comment on, and also the very popular televangelists that I think came up in those years, Jim and Tammy Baker, and the others I'm forgetting. I mean, there were several. Not Falwell. Who was the guy that was I've sinned. The televangelist that was, oh God, his name escapes me now. But we were watching this new phenomenon of religion and commerce and politics. And
this was in the late 80s.
Yeah, it was right in those 86, 87, 88. As a matter of fact, it was just after we presented this play on stage that Jim and Tammy Baker sort of fell out of favor with their scandals. And Jimmy Swaggart is the name I've forgotten.
Right.
Jimmy Swaggart was caught in his love triangle or whatever the heck it was. And people thought that we were chasing the news, that, oh, we were just doing it because now it's in the headlines. But this is a project that we had been developing for months.
Is it based, as a character of Reverend Cotton Slocum, for example, based on any particular televangelist or religious right leader? Or is it just sort of a fictitious
character? Not necessarily. Yeah, it's kind of an amalgam of all those guys. Jerry Falwell, I think, is probably the biggest influence. Just through his audacity and his sheer ridiculousness. Well, you know, the man's passed, and God bless his soul now. But, I mean, you know, it's just some of the things he would say, outlandish and ridiculous. And, you know, it was something we thought as a theater group that likes to present theater that has a bite, a social and political bite to it. We thought this was perfect.
My guest is V.J. Foster. He is the Associate Artistic Director and one of the actors in the play Carnage, a comedy brought to us by the Actors Gang. And he plays the Reverend Cotton Slocum. So, is there a way for us to hear a little bit about what the Reverend Cotton Slocum has to say?
First, he'll come into his service. He'll see his thousands and thousands of followers in his beautiful building. It's a mega church he's got. And as the lights are dimming, you might hear from the back of the house, "Doomed." That's right, sir, you are doomed. Doomed, ma'am. Doomed. That cloth coat won't save you. You're doomed. You, doomed. 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 You're okay over here, that's right. For the rest of you, well, I'll tell you, when that rapture day comes, and it's a-coming soon, I know, because he told me. When that day comes, you had better be ready. You'd better be ready to stand there naked, bare-assed, blue-cheeked, and be judged. Now, I ask you, what do you think he is going to say, huh? Oh, that's all right. I don't mind you drinking a little alcohol, oh, that's just fine. A little adultery, no problem. Well, forget it, Jiminy, because it's the clean jeans that are going to be lifted right up. And you, well, the rest of you are going to be sitting in a pile of burning rubble, watching your skin fall off your bones 999 days of burning hell on earth. How's that grab you? Something to think about. And then we might move on into more.
That's the Reverend Cotton Slocum, but it's really my guest, V.J. Foster, who plays the Reverend in Carnage, a comedy. It is showing Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m., February 2nd through March 8th. And It's going to be at the Actors Gang. Actors Gang has its own space. Is that right?
That's right. We're in Culver City. We are at the historical Ivy substation. We've taken over. The Ivy substation was converted to a professional theater by the Center Theater Group before they moved to the Kirk Douglas Theater in Culver City. And then the Actors Gang was given a 10-year lease on it. So that's our home. We are loving it. It's beautiful. It's right at the corner of Venice Boulevard and Culver Boulevard, where they intersect there near Robertson in Culver City.
And the address is 9070 Venice Boulevard.
That's right.
And let me just give the information if listeners are interested in reservations. You can call 310-838-GANG. That's 310-838-4264.
That's right.
For Carnage, a comedy. My guest is Vijay Foster. He is the Associate Artistic Director. Tim Robbins is also involved in this. Tim Robbins, artist, an activist. He is the Artistic Director of Carnage, a comedy. So who are some of the other characters in this play, Vijay, and who are some of the actors too involved in bringing this play to light and making it sort of bigger than just the Reverend Cotton Slocum?
Well, yeah, as a collaborative group, we've throughout our history developed pieces just from an idea in workshop where we present a premise. Okay, let's talk about televangelism. Let's talk about right-wing leaning preachers and this new moral majority sort of, this is, remember, 1986, new moral majority political bent and what they're trying to say, what they're trying to do, the activism that they are trying to present in America. And let's, as actors, bring this kind of energy and this comment to our theater. And so we will put ourselves in image. We'll decide, okay, this is a televangelist, probably heavy set, very well dressed, very well appointed with his followers, and he might have a young deacon and chief of staff and his beautiful over-made-up wife, perhaps, and then the various characters that might follow this person, you know, the young, struggling blue-collar couple, the wife who is devoted to Jesus and her Bible and the teachings of Reverend Cotton Slocum, and her somewhat more skeptical drinking husband who works hard and never has enough money and is never quite sold on this religious message and never quite understands why his wife is. And then, you know, through misadventure, the young deacon deciding that the church is not militant enough. Through his travels and his life's journey, he's been taught that world politics is a dangerous stage, and one must be a little bit more proactive in their politics in order to affect change. So he goes about taking over the church. And so it's this story, you know, where you can talk about religious fervor and true believers married that with a militaristic sort of proactivism. I don't know if that's the correct terminology. But this idea that religion for religion's sake is not enough, that you have to take up the sword and carry the battle truly to the battlefield. And, you know, in light of what we've seen in our history here in these last few years, and what religion, no, the specter of a militant religious philosophy and what it means for our society, for the world community, it's really very frightening.
Have you gotten any critiques from people who think that that you're caricaturizing Christian fundamentalists and that it's unfair or you're picking on Christianity, etc.?
Well, when we did this play years ago, yes, we did. We heard all that. We heard, you know, throughout the spectrum of people that loved it and thought it had something very important to say, and other people that thought it was, you know, just hitting the nail a little too much on the head, or that it was a little, you know, comment, the biting commentary was not doing anybody any good, or that you're just, you know, poking fun at really caricatures, people that are caricatures of themselves, these people that we see on television. But, you know, we just go about doing our business, you know, which is to try to make a comment on cultural phenomena that you know presents itself to us in our world that we feel like has maybe too much power. Is religion, personally, and I can speak personally because I just feel that this play lives because of a failure of religion. Hmm. I do believe that religion has failed us. It was meant to bring people together, and I think that what we've seen more and more is that it just creates these camps. And I'm not talking about spirituality. I think that spirituality is so very important, and one's relationship to a higher being goes beyond words. But religion, organized religion, and what it's done and what it's meant, and we're talking about issues of life and death and war and peace, and I think that that by its very nature has meant failure. So we, as a theater company, want to comment on this. And, you know, for the sole objective of getting people to think, getting people to discuss, and if they disagree, that's great. Why do they disagree? And let's talk about that. Let's have this dialogue. That's the whole point of what we try to do.
I've been speaking with V.J. Foster, Associate Artistic Director at the Actors Gang. He plays the character of Reverend Cotton Slocum at Carnage, a comedy which is opening on February 2nd at the Actors Gang, located at Ivy Substation, 9070 Venice Boulevard in Culver City. The play will be showing Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m., February 2nd through March 8th. And for tickets, you can call 310-838-4264. That's 310-838-4264, or you can visit theactorsgang.com. That's theactorsgang.com. After this week's Peace Vigil announcements, we'll take a look at Proposition 92 and hear two different perspectives. But before we go to this week's Peace Vigil announcements, we have five pairs of tickets to give away to Friday, February 8th, showing of Carnage, a comedy. That's five pairs of tickets at 818-985-5735, the first five callers. It's our thank you to you for continually supporting KPFK and listening to KPFK. If you'd like to go see Carnage, a comedy, next Friday, February 8th at 8 p.m. at Ivy Substation, 9070 Venice Boulevard in Culver City, call us at 818-985-5735. We'll be right back.
It's time for our weekly Peace Vigil announcements. I'm Gabriel San Roman. Neighborhood activists all over Southern California hold regular peace vigils to end the war in Iraq. Each week we announce just some of the 50-plus vigils that are taking place. Complete listings of all the vigils are available at www.neighborsforpeaceandjustice.org or www.peacevigils.com. On the first Sunday of each month in Woodland Hills, there's a peace vigil from 5 to 6 p.m. on the corner of Topanga and Oxnard Boulevards. The email contact is renelancon@aol.com. That's renelancon@aol.com. On Fridays in Alhambra from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., there's a peace vigil at the corner of Main Street and Garfield Avenue in front of Edwards Stadium 14 Theater. On Fridays in Claremont from 4:30 to 6 p.m., there's a peace vigil on the corner of Indian Hill Boulevard and Arrow Highway. And the information line is 909-399-3451 or 909-621-5811. On Fridays in Echo Park from 5 to 7 p.m., there's a peace vigil on the corner of Echo Park and Sunset Boulevard. And the information line is 213-250-5500 during the day and 323-660-4799 during the evenings. On Friday in Los Angeles from 5 to 6 p.m., there's a peace vigil on the corner of Pico and La Cienega Boulevards. The email contact is nfuller@netwood.net. That's nfuller@netwood.net. On Fridays in Pasadena at 12 noon, there's a peace vigil on the corner of Cordova Street and Lake Avenue. The information line is 626-799-7786. Again, that's 626-799-7786. On Saturdays in Anaheim, there's a peace vigil at 1 p.m. at La Palma Park. The email contact is foodnotbombsanaheim@gmail.com, and the information line is 714-526-3576. And finally, on Saturdays in Laguna Beach, there's a peace vigil from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Pacific Coast Highway and Ocean Avenue on the main beach. The information line is 949-499-3190. Again, that's 949-499-3190. A complete list of vigils is available at www.neighborsforpeaceandjustice.org or www.peacevigils.com. Special thanks to Jennifer Hiller.
Welcome back to Uprising. Proposition 92 on Tuesday's ballot could affect 2.5 million students on over 100 community college campuses statewide. If passed, Prop 92 would mean a constitutional amendment that would decrease student fees from $20 to $15 per unit, increase the number of members of the Board of Governors, and change the funding formula in a way that proponents say will stabilize community college funding. Many educators and students are in favor of Prop 92, including the California Federation of Teachers, the Los Angeles College Faculty Guild, the California School Employees Association, and the Community College Association. But many are also opposing it, including the League of Women Voters of California, the California Faculty Association, California Teachers Association, and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Opponents of Prop 92 say it would write another complicated funding formula into the California Constitution without providing an additional source of revenue. It would also make it nearly impossible to raise fees in the future, regardless of the state's budget. My guests this morning are Carl Friedlander. He is with the Los Angeles College Faculty Guild, and his organization takes a yes position on Prop 92. And Eric Hines is a fourth grade teacher at Pittsburgh United School District in Contra Costa County and board member of the California Teachers Association. The CTA opposes Prop 92. Welcome to Uprising, Carl and Eric.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us today. Carl, I'd like to start with you. What do you make of the opposition's contention that Prop 92 would just make the California Constitution much more complicated, wouldn't guarantee a source of revenue to fund any sort of shortfall in community college funding?
It doesn't make it more complicated. What it does is it fixes a problem in Prop 98, which, if left unfixed, will pull down community colleges in California over the next few years.
Give us a little bit of background on Prop 98.
Well, Prop 98 funds K-12 and community colleges in the state, but there are a couple of problems. First of all, the split between K-12 and community colleges, although it's supposed to be around 11%, has never been followed. It's been, you know, all over the map in different years, although never at the level it should be. This proposition sets the split in law so there won't be a tussle between community colleges and K-12 every year. But the other thing that it does is, as we enter a period where K-12 enrollment is declining across the state, but where community college funding is tied to that declining K-12 enrollment, it separates the measures for growth in the system so that the students who need to attend community colleges won't be penalized by the fact that younger students, that demographically, that enrollment is declining across the state. So that's what it does. And then there's the fee piece, but that's the funding piece that you asked about.
Let's talk to Eric Hines. You are on the board of the California Teachers Association, and you don't like Proposition 92. What do you make of what Carl just said?
Well, I think, first of all, let me start by saying that we all support community colleges and we support more funding for community colleges. Our problem with Prop 92, first of all, that it creates this huge new mandated spending for the Legislative Analyst Office thinks about $300,000 per year for the next 3 years. That's almost $1 billion with no way to pay for it. It doesn't provide necessarily stable funding, because some students move on to community colleges, Prop 98 provides a consistent funding formula that bases on student enrollment increases. What Proposition 92 does is that it bases funding on the general population increases rather than the number of students attending schools or colleges. And that's one reason that it's going to be very expensive and no way to pay for it.
Now, Eric, but what about the fact that from year to year, community colleges don't know how to set their next year's budget because each year it's different?
Well, you know, the CTA is working with some community colleges and so to make sure that community colleges get their stable or get their 11% that's guaranteed under Proposition 98. The problem with Proposition 92 is that it doesn't solve the problem. It actually creates more problems by creating this extra mandate for extra spending but it doesn't provide a way to pay for it. So that money is going to come from somewhere, and that money is going to come from either other higher ed, Cal States or UCs, or it's going to come from the K-12 system. And it's, and once we have it, it's practically unchangeable because it requires a 4/5 majority or 80% yes vote to change it.
Hmm. Carl, let's hear your response to this, that it actually does make it more complicated. And also, if you can give our listeners some background on where Prop 92 itself came from, how did it get on the ballot, who put it on the ballot?
Well, it was really the all segments of the community college system in the state coming together to put this on the ballot. And the reason that it was put on the ballot, and I want to focus on this, is because the fact is that over the next few years, we read it in the papers all the time, across the state, K-12 enrollment is in a slight decline. And that is the driver with Prop 98 funding. But the bulge of students that pass through K-12, the baby boom echo, is now of college age. So those kids who've gone through K-12, now adults, are on our doorstep ready to attend community college, but the funding formula is going to have the result of slamming the door in their faces because we're tied to the K-12 enrollment decline. The K-12 per student funding won't decline, but community college funding will. So actually what CPA keeps talking about is a huge new mandate is actually a much smaller obligation than the state would have if K-12 enrollment were growing. And they certainly wouldn't call that a huge mandate for the state that we can't afford to fund the growth of K-12 students. But somehow, when it's college-age students who need to attend community colleges, it's called a huge new mandate. It's actually far less than the cost would be if we were experiencing growth in the K-12 system.
And I want to ask Eric to respond to that. But first, Carl, what about the fact that Prop 92, if it passed, it would reduce per unit student fees from $20 to $15. Some would argue that even that $20 per unit is affordable enough.
Well, I guess affordability is in the eyes of the beholder. If you look at our student population, you know, we have probably the majority of our students in community colleges across the state are in, you know, very low-income situations. The students who get the fees waived across the state earn less than $15,000 a year. And so everybody who is in this system, including the CTA people who are in community colleges, will tell you that the history is every time fees go up even a dollar or two, enrollment declines across the state. When fees go down, enrollment goes up. We've watched that history in the 25 years since fees were instituted.
Okay.
So they're lower than the rest of the country, but as far as I'm concerned, they're not low enough.
Eric, let's get your response to what Carl said, that this talk of a very large mandate is unfounded.
Well, the problem is it does cost extra money, and it doesn't provide any extra way to pay for it. Nobody's arguing that the community colleges need more money, as do the K-12 system and the CSU system and the UC system. I mean, we all need more money, and in fact, what we need to find is a way to deal with the overall problem, not this kind of ballot box budgeting that they're trying to do with Prop 92. But the problem is that, and the other issue around the drop in the fees, students that can't afford the $20 fee already have the option to waive the fee, and in fact about 52% of the students attending community colleges already are on a fee waiver. And in fact, the real cost of going to college, about 90% of the cost of going to college, in fact, things like housing and the cost of books and the cost of child care and food and those kinds of things are not addressed under Proposition 92, so it won't even do what it says. It will increase access.
Mm. Well, Eric, what about, I mean, does it seem that this disagreement over Prop 92 is symbolic of the fact that across the state of California, educational resources and the people who are involved in education are fighting for crumbs, that there's this, seems to be this competition set up because of our budget structure and, of course, because of the budget shortfalls and declining enrollment, a whole host of reasons that there's this competition between K-12 public educators, community college educators and students, et cetera. What do you think, Eric?
Well, I think that's really a false competition. I think California needs to step up to the plate and fund public education at the levels that it if it wants, you know, a world-class system, we've got to step up to the plate and pay for a world-class system. And in fact, Proposition 92 is only going to make that worse. what we need to do is come up with a solution that includes a myriad of different, you know, it's not just a single solution, but includes a myriad of different things that includes things like revenue enhancements and looking at other issues that can address the whole system. I mean, the K-12 system is already funded about $1,500 under the national average. And as we look at the budget crisis that's coming up next year, the $14.5 billion, I think we're just exacerbating it with Proposition 92 because it's so flawed.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left. I want to give both of you a chance to give our listeners your pitch, your one-minute pitch for why you should either vote for or vote against Prop 92. Carl, go first. You think that Prop 92 is worth voting for. Exactly why?
I do, because California's community colleges are democracy's colleges. This is a system that serves 2.5 million students, that provides access to careers, to low-cost, high-quality transfer to four-year schools for students who could not have that and who don't have it in other states. And by passing Prop 92, we can keep our doors open to the next generation of students. We can build the state's economy by providing them with careers, training, transfer opportunities that they will not have if Prop 92 does not pass, and that access will be denied to this next generation.
Eric Hines, your one-minute pitch to our listeners on why Prop 92 you think is a bad idea?
Well, I think, first of all, funding community colleges at the level they need to be funded, I think, is a good idea. Proposition 92 is bad because it locks in new state spending with no way to pay for it. It's going to worsen our budget deficit and threaten funding for other programs that we care about. And it does nothing to really increase access to for student enrollment, and in fact expands bureaucracy with no accountability and absolutely no guarantee that the money is even going to be spent on students.
Well, I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us today. Eric Hines, fourth grade teacher at Pittsburgh United School District in Contra Costa County and board member of the California Teachers Association. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thank you.
And Carl Friedlander, a Los Angeles College Faculty Guild member. And thank you very much, Carl, for joining us.
My pleasure.
And if you are confused about Prop 92 still, you can check out and do your own research on their websites. Yes on Proposition 92 has a website at prop92yes.com. That's Prop 92, the numbers, yes.com, and No on Proposition 92 has www.noprop92.org, noprop92.org, and we will link to those two websites from our site later today, uprisingradio.org, which, by the way, you can check out our website to hear any of our interviews that you might have missed. Everything is archived. Audio archives are all available. Everything is archived in MP3 format, and you can listen to them, pass them along to your friend, comment on each show as well. That's uprisingradio.org. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, I'd like to quote George Peabody, who said once, "Education is a debt due from present to future generations." That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. And next week, Uprising will be taking our program on the road. We'll be going to college campuses around the primary elections and doing live remote broadcasts, so stay tuned for that. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website, uprisingradio.org. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.